Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Just about once a month, we sit down with Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles to talk about what's been going on in the city and in city government. And today is that day, and the mayor is back with us. Welcome.
Good morning. How is it going?
Well, it's a little wet, but aside from that, great.
A little bit wet, yeah. So I still think about the victims of the storm, I mean, Florida, and already the recovery effort that Governor Cooper is taking place in Wilmington and the eastern part of the state, and they're going to get more rain.
Right.
And we know that that saturation of rain can cause real problems.
The last time you were here, mm-hmm. It was the day before Florence, and we spent a lot of time talking about the city's preparations for Florence. Did the city make any extra special preparations for Michael?
Yes, we activated the hurricane team and particularly focused on the weather reports and getting different folks to come out and confirm what our projections are. So we think this rain's going to last until the afternoon. What we're thinking more about is the wind gusts mm-hmm. that will come between, we're estimating, 4 and 5:30 during the commute in Charlotte. So we're working on helping people or notifying the major businesses, the government offices that are downtown to say, you know, look at this and determine what's best for your employees mm-hmm. to make sure that they're safe because the commute will be difficult.
So you can't tell them they have to dismiss people on a rolling schedule. What you're asking that?
Well, you know, yesterday I was at Bank of America for a program on education, and I heard the employees talking with their boss, and they were saying what it's going to go on tomorrow. And I believe most of our downtown employers mm-hmm. have really good ideas about weather and inclement weather policy, so I'm sure they'll follow those.
Okay. As we go through this conversation, I want to remind folks that they can join us via email, charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook. You can get to us through Twitter @CharlotteTalks. You can watch us on Facebook Live. You had a busy, busy Monday night at the City
yes,
Council.
Yes, we did.
You approved a series of land deals to help meet the city's affordable housing goals, which I think you helped set to a large measure. Five measures passed with a single vote. Is that the normal way council deals with these things, five at a time?
No, it's certainly not normal for us to adopt these kinds of business items that implement our policy. I can't be more proud of the city council, the city staff, and our community for really understanding that this is an issue that is going to be so important in this decade, with new people coming in, with people that are now in a situation where they're living in places and they're being displaced. It was a great night. It included not only land deals, but we acquired the Oaklawn Avenue Elementary School.
Right.
And the thought of what you can do with that kind of acreage and combine it in a mixed income, mixed use on that part of town, I think we're delivering on our promise to be active, that we're going to work and develop on the west side. I can't say enough about the work of the Ed Driggs and Luana Mayfield. Luana chairs that group, but the council singularly, unanimously, have focused on this effort, and we're making change.
Is it Oaklawn Elementary or Double Oaks? Everything
Double
I've
Oaks,
read.
I'm okay, sorry, Double okay. Oaks. Right. It's on Oaklawn Avenue. It's Double Oaks. Okay. I apologize.
So let's go through some of these things that you did on Monday night. You decided to sell three city-owned parcels of land. You made a land donation to Habitat for Humanity. You bought the former Double Oaks Elementary School from Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools for $3.1 million. One at a time, where are these three parcels of land?
Well, they're primarily in the inner city. One particular one is on Parkwood Avenue. When you see how Belmont is changing, we're going to preserve, you know, places where people with between 80% and 50% of average median income, which is in the mid-50s in Charlotte, we're going to be able to reserve those places for the development. So most of those are along that corridor. And then, of course, Double Oak School is on Oaklawn, a beautiful street in on the west side with really wonderful houses that are two-story and a lot of repair and renovation going on there. And the Habitat group will be on over 9 acres, and they'll be building single-family homes.
Okay. Now, Is there a buyer, aside from the habit, for the three parcels that you're going to mm-hmm. that you've decided to sell, is there a buyer identified?
Right now, on the Parkwood Avenue portion, yes, there is a buyer. He's going to develop both market rate as well as affordable, which is really important because we don't want to just have people come in and say, well, we're concentrating in one area. So we're looking at these deals in a way that develops our philosophy that we ought to have mixed income neighborhoods.
But that Parkwood site, I think it's a quarter acre on Parkwood at the Plaza.
Yeah.
Is that right? Where one in five, 20% of the units will be affordable. How many units is he building?
He's building the five.
So one of those units will be
yes.
affordable. On the Spencer Street acre, what's a 1.4 acres on Spencer Street for 59 townhomes, mm-hmm. 10 of which will be, must be, affordable.
That's right.
And then the other one is a third acre on Matheson, where one of the new single family homes would be affordable. How do you enforce that you sell the property to the developer?
Well, we sell it with covenants in the sale document. All of these are transactions that are legally reviewed to make sure that we make our intent of preservation. One of the issues that often even Habitat had to deal with this is that you could go into a Habitat home or one of these homes and you're growing gain equity. And then you say, oh, let me just sell because I want to take out my equity. We've put in deed restrictions, sales contract restrictions that doesn't allow that to happen because we're investing long-term for affordability.
Eli Portillo in the Charlotte Observer reports that the Parkwood Avenue property is valued at $209,300, but it has a purchase price of $140,000. So you are discounting the land to the developer. They have to sell one of those five townhomes at below market value. I think the market value is either $200,000 or that is the market value.
I think that the market value may even grow and increase beyond that.
But they have to sell it below market value.
Right.
And you found a developer who has agreed.
The developer that of the entire parcel with the four affordable, one affordable and the four others, he has agreed.
Okay. Have you reached an agreement with CMS on the $3.1 million purchase price
yes.
for Double Oaks?
We've been working on school properties a very long time. I want to say that the superintendent has engaged with us in this conversation. I hope that we'll be able to do more of those sites.
What will be built there? Do you know?
Well, we're not sure yet, but it's going to be mixed income and mixed use.
So there's a way for you to ensure that the developers to whom you are selling this land will put affordable units on those pieces of property. What happens when the first owner decides to sell? Are there deed restrictions?
There are restrictions. I'm not sure.
Permanent deed restrictions going forward forever?
These are deeds for 15 to 20 years. That's what we're trying to use as our average to make sure that they stay affordable for that time period and time frame.
Okay, and there are also plans, I'm told, to develop 100 affordable housing units at Scaly Bark, the Scaly Bark Station, a mixed-use development that's kind of been stalled for a long, long time.
I think we've had Scaly Bark since 2007, mm-hmm. and then the recession hit the housing industry, and we have struggled with a decision around that for 4 years. I'm really, really glad that we are able to get that site and that we'll be able to actually put in affordable units, and it will be next to market rate.
Was that part of this vote on Monday night?
It was not part of that vote. It's something that we've been working on, and I think that we've moved in that direction over 6 weeks ago.
Okay.
More.
So what kinds of income levels are required to qualify to be in these affordable units?
The way I look at it, it's really the idea is that if you're working in just a income level, I would say like a teacher. They come in, I believe, right at $30,000, and a teacher can go up to $50,000. Almost every teacher in that price range would be able to afford these units for sale or for rental discounts there. So we're really looking at teachers and entry-level positions professionally, but also think about this in the healthcare industry. The number of people that work in the healthcare industry at $12 and $15 an hour, licensed practical nursing, the people that work in food service, all of those will be able. We really look at 50 to 80% as our place for the city to do affordable housing. in income.
And in terms of construction and amenities, et cetera, will there be a substantial difference between the affordable units in these developments versus the full price units in these developments, or do you know?
You remember Optimus Park. I've been here long enough to remember when Optimus Park was developed by Habitat. And you basically got a house that had, you walked in off of the stoop onto the front door. If you'll look at what Habitat builds now, it is entirely different. It fits in with the design standards that we would want for any market rate unit. And that's what we're building now. We're building to design standards. You should never be able to drive through a neighborhood and say, oh, that's the unit that's, you know, they're paying less than I am. That's just inappropriate for us to do as a policy.
Wouldn't be good for the builder either, it would seem to me.
It would not be good for the builder. Yeah. You're right about that.
You're also donating 9 acres on Morris Field Drive, which is near the airport, to Habitat. Have they decided how many houses they will build there or what they will be building there?
They will be building single-family homes. Okay. And so we know that. I don't have the design. And, you know, a lot of this, you get the land, and then you go through the permitting process. Mm-hmm. And there are things that are usually negotiated. You know, usually it's about, you know, how much vinyl can be on a building, how many parking spaces, whether you have rollout or dumpsters. These are the kind of things that government examines in our zoning to make sure our neighborhoods can be preserved and they are neighborhoods that people can all feel comfortable in and safe.
We had some real estate folks on the show not too long ago. And
I think I heard
that. An agent, a developer, a builder, and somebody from the real estate agent, real estate business. Mm-hmm. And they were complaining about zoning regulations and restrictions put on it by the city and the county that make it impossible to build affordable stuff or make it very difficult to keep prices down. For instance, they complained about sidewalks. They complained about the need to put trees in. They complained about the need to put bicycle lanes down some of the roads. You're smiling at me like...
Well,
that's just nonsense.
Well, no, I don't think it's nonsense. No, those are all items that cost. But the cost today is less than what we would be paying in the future when people walk in and say, we want a walkable city.
But they're saying that makes it prohibitive for them to even make an attempt at building these things.
All I can say is that at one time we had one housing developer for affordable housing. Today we have over six. We have people knocking at the door to be a part of this effort. And so when people say that those are issues, I believe that because there's costs. But we do not have a problem with getting people that want to do this the right way.
And if you listen to them and you read between the lines, what they're saying is that people want a roof over their head. And the tree in the front yard and the sidewalk down the street is icing on the cake that they can live without, because what they want is square footage, value for their money, and that doesn't add square footage or value to their buying proposition. What do you say to that?
So when people come to our city, what's the first thing they talk about? Our tree canopy. If we're going to build and the density of, and the rapid rate of development, if we don't enforce those things about trees and sidewalks, it will come back to bite us. It will come back and they'll be standing in front of the city council saying, why don't I look like this neighborhood? Why can't I be like Sedgefield? Why can't I be like Macquarie Heights? Do it now when the cost and the development and the construction is going on. It's going to be a great investment.
Speaking of now, in the 45 seconds that we have, the city's owned this land for a while, I would think, and there's probably more that you own. What made this the right time to sell all this?
Staff gave us a list of every property that we owned, and we're going through that to say which ones are ready, where do we have people want to develop it. Mm-hmm. And that's the first group that you saw.
How much more property do you
own?
Oh my
gosh,
the city have
at its disposal? I would say that it's an Excel spreadsheet with at least 5 pages. And it's available to the public if they'd like to see it. Any developer.
10-point font. All right, we have to take a break. Mayor Vi Lyles is with us. We'll come back and talk about a lot of different things and more about this sale of property for affordable housing and good-paying jobs, among other things. Stay with us. It's Charlotte Talks. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles is with us for our monthly conversation. We started out by talking about affordable housing. A few more things to look into with regard to that. In addition to selling land, the city is also getting ready to buy land. For what purpose?
We have a land acquisition policy for roads and sidewalks and storm drainage and things like that. So all we're doing is expanding that policy so that we can buy land for affordable housing. And that's going to be an important aspect of our framework for implementation of the bonds.
And where does the money come from? Is that from the previous bonds and the new bonds if they pass?
It is from the previous bonds as well as what we call our pay-as-you-go fund, where we have cash available from the taxpayers' dollars, and we're using it to implement this policy to move more quickly. You know, land is not getting cheaper in Charlotte. In fact, it's escalating in value. So we're going to use what tools we have, funding that we have, to get in there and buy this property as quickly as we can.
Studies say that the city lacks about 24,000 affordable housing units for people making less than 50% of the area's median income, which I believe is somewhere in the neighborhood of $37,000 for a family of four. And we have lost nearly half of our total supply, 28,000 units of older, cheaper, affordable housing since 2013. So these planned projects won't even make a dent, will they? I mean, what you sold on Monday night, if I did the math right, amounts to about 7 or 8 units of housing. So when we're talking about 7 or 8 units versus the need of 28,000.
Well, you got to start. And I believe in that. I believe that you have to get going, and you've got to get a plan in place to do this. So, no, we've never said that we're going to solve every deficit that we have or every deficit we have in affordable housing. But I will say this, that we're bringing attention to the issue, and we're getting cooperation from people that understand. Particularly, we look at the private sector fundraiser. We're going in our framework. When we talk about that, we're doing more than building. We have opportunities to renovate and rehab. And actually, in our areas that are close by where seniors are staying, we're going to go in and help them maintain their properties so that they aren't increasing that number. It would be great to make a dent in that number and not have it increase. But I want to say one thing. One of our issues is with the idea that we have to have some help from the federal government when we talk about people that are making 30%. And so we have, we're beginning that conversation with the Charlotte Housing Authority. We're talking about it with the federal government administration. We have to have some help. If people are coming here looking for work and they can't find work that allows them to rent even at our subsidized or affordable units, then we still will have this problem.
Are you likely to get that help?
We're gonna give it our best effort. I'm going to be talking about it with the administration in Washington. We're going to be talking about it with the state financing agency in Raleigh. We're talking with every institution that has affordable housing as a part of their mission. I haven't been told no yet.
Okay.
So until they say no, we're going to say we're going to make this happen for Charlotte.
I was going to ask you if past is prologue, what do you think? But it's a different administration now, so they may have a different set of values. Are there any tools in the city's toolkit that could encourage people who already own housing units, whether they're single family or townhomes or apartments, to make or keep them affordable as opposed to selling? Because what's happening now in a lot of places is gentrification is going on, and people are taking affordable houses, buying them, tearing them down, and putting a $1 million home in its place. Is there anything that the city can do to sweeten the deal for people to maintain those homes?
You know, Mike, people often talk about that, you know, $1 million house being placed there. About 8 weeks ago, I went off Statesville Avenue, close to where J.T. Williams School is, and there is a cluster of affordable units in that area, brick duplexes, and they needed some care and attention. And we went in there, and we looked at it, and we said, these things need to be fixed. If they're not fixed, then we're going to have a problem. So instead of talking about moving people out, we put in a team to go in and talk to the property owner and talk about his renovation. How do we make that affordable for him in terms of using the housing bonds to renovate those units and have him sign an agreement to keep the rents affordable? That's the way that we deal with it.
But are they losing money? For instance, right behind the new Harris Teeter on South Boulevard.
Yes.
They have torn down brick. Yes. I guess they were apartment homes.
They were duplexes. Apartment homes, you're right.
Hundreds of them in there. And, yes. And there's more that they haven't gotten to yet, but I'm sure they will. And I'm sure that they're going to put in the kind of development that's on the other side of South Boulevard, which are these new, quote-unquote, luxury apartment units. Well, if you're a business person, there's a lot more money to be made that way, isn't there?
You know, that decision on that zoning of that property was made years ago.
Okay.
And we probably didn't have
the tools. So you
wouldn't
have done it that way.
Well, you know what? We'd be sitting down and talking with the developer about opportunities that he could use to join with us to provide housing. One of our missed opportunities, and we all acknowledge this, is along the transit line, not actually having a requirement or actually buying more land than necessary. When we talk about the next transit line, we're going to be looking at our affordable housing policy in conjunction with. That didn't happen years ago.
Is it too late along the extension to the university to get some affordable housing along that line?
I think that what you'll see there, and you know, more than you want to know about a quarter mile versus a half mile. Mm-hmm. I think the quarter mile, we missed the opportunity. In the half mile, we're looking for those opportunities now.
So Katie on Facebook writes, I'm a huge supporter of mixed income housing. Please don't allow developers to tie you to unreasonable rezonings in order to get increased density and commercial property included in their project. I also believe the homes should be integrated with the other units in order not for them to not seem stigmatized. So the two of you,
we are on the same page, Katie.
Page.
Thank you.
So how far, there's a $50 million bond, affordable housing bond, on the ballot next month. How far will that $50 million go if voters say yes to it?
You know, what we would not want to do is say anything that would make us in a position where we'd spend it all so quickly that we wouldn't be able to get the outcomes that we expect. So I say this because we can certainly go out and buy and build, but building in Charlotte is very expensive. So that's why the framework includes multiple tools. So the renovation money, I think, is a high priority out of the bond issue. Acquisition of land outside of the center city is an important part of that. So my goal is that I'm really asking every citizen, early voting starts October 17th, to go out and vote yes for our bonds, for the housing bonds, for the neighborhood bonds, and for our transportation bonds. Go out, vote yes, and then we'll be able to talk about what tools are most important. But I think you'll see renovation with deed restrictions or rent agreements, covenants there, more than we'll see new construction.
So you can advocate for the bonds?
I can advocate for the bonds. That's a good thing about being mayor. I get to say things that I really like to say, and I want the community to understand and do. So I'm asking people to come out and vote for the bonds.
Well, you're working with some high power people here, because I just got this yesterday in my email. You are going out with the Hamilton Company that's in town at the
yes.
Belk. To drum up votes, to bring out the vote. What are you doing exactly? This is Friday,
yes,
11:30 to 1, with the Hamilton folks. Are they going to be in costume? Are they going to perform a number? What's going on?
I don't know whether they're going to be in costume or perform, but I'm just honored to say that Lynn Miranda and his family foundation, they are all about registering people to vote. So when we talk about 60 people coming to Charlotte every day, and perhaps they go right into one of those towers and they're working, did they register to vote? So we're going to be at the Blumenthal, I think we're going to be outside of the Blumenthal in the plaza area, asking people to register to vote so that they can vote in this upcoming election.
Okay. And the weather will be nice. So,
can I say one other thing about
sure.
Lynn Miranda? He is actually hosting for over 2,000 Title I students a matinee performance of Hamilton. And I can't be more proud. Again, Charlotte is working so hard, and Mecklenburg County Schools working so hard, that we're going to be able to partner with him, and they are going to work with the kids to learn what they do. They're going to have them perform before the cast, and then they're going to invite them to a matinee. So I just want to say thank you to the Miranda Family Foundation for making that possible.
Great. You've also called for updates on conditions at the Lake Arbor Apartments. Evidently, Fox 46 television uncovered what they described as deplorable conditions there. What were those conditions?
You know, we've got a property that was built and exactly around the kind of issues that we are talking about. Older properties that are not being maintained appropriately by the owner. In this case, the owner doesn't live here. They don't have the commitment to this community. This is something they have regional units like this all over the East Coast, and they got behind in their maintenance. Now, sometimes you can never, there are always partners and people in this. So is it the property management company that's supposed to inspect the apartments and maintain them before they get to a condition where they're not habitable? And we found 11 units over there that we had to immediately move people out of them because they were not safe. And that is not the way that we want our citizens to be treated. The people, the residents of that community deserve more. So now we're in negotiation with this new owner to say, what are you going to do and how? What is the time frame?
How much control do you have over that?
We have a minimum housing code. And that's what we can use to enforce. Now, it doesn't include all of the things that the tenants are worried about. But at the same time, there is that tool. And then we also, if you don't meet that minimum standard, I don't know if people are aware, we have an environmental court where we can bring that owner in and the judge can make a ruling that those units must be either renovated or they be demolished. And so this is a case off of Tuckasegee Road that is an affordable complex with over 290 units. And we found code violations in 260 units. Wow. And that is unacceptable in our city.
Did code enforcement find those violations on its own or through reports from tenants, or did that come from the Fox 46 report?
The Fox reporter is reporting on what the tenants have stepped up to do.
Okay. So, one final comment about affordable housing before we move on. From Helen on Facebook, who should I contact, she writes, about getting an affordable unit?
It depends. You can call SocialServe or go online to SocialServe.com. They are keeping our inventory of affordable properties right now.
Okay. City Council on Monday also decided to spend $60,000 on a contract with 25 to 27 Cleaning, if that's how you say it. This is the company that cleans four light rail facilities. But there was concern by some councilmen, particularly Braxton Winston and Matt Newton. They voted against the contract because the company pays only $11 or $12 per hour, while a livable wage in Charlotte starts at around $17 an hour. And Winston said that the people cleaning the trains and buses can't afford to ride them at that salary. So one of the city council's top priorities is creating good-paying jobs. So why the vote?
Well, I think the vote is why the vote. I think, first of all, it became an issue because Councilmember Winston decided at the dais that we should talk about this issue of what I call wage inequity. Where people aren't able to really live in our community. I know that the council completely supports the idea of doing living wage. We did that for our own employees at $15 an hour, plus they have benefits. And so that's an important thing. We would not have done it for the number of people that over our 8,000 employees, those that qualify, if we didn't care. I think I have two issues that we're wrestling with. There is the substantive issue of how to do this. And if you look at Bank of America, Wells Fargo, the two healthcare systems, Novant and Atrium, they've all agreed to go to that 15.
Okay.
And when you have a small business and a small minority business, what we look at is also the understanding that we need to grow our businesses. And so part of the issue is when we're doing this, what are we doing to impact that business as well after going through a bid process, a contract, and we're the final step in that process. We can't
and
go back.
But that's the only leverage that the city really has over private businesses. You can either accept a contract with somebody who's going to pay their employees less than the livable wage, or you can look for somebody else who will pay a livable wage. That's the only leverage you have, isn't
Actually,
it?
Actually, no, that's state law will not allow us to prescribe for contractors the the wages of their employees.
No, but you can look for a company that, pays that living wage and give the contract to them.
No, because the state law says we must take the lowest bid on a contract. So, you know, that's why on the side of this, we need to have a policy discussion, and it was difficult to do that in the moment.
Okay.
So when you're going to talk about how do we deal with this, we have to have the facts in front of us. And part of this is that I think everyone in our council's willing to have that conversation, but you can't do it at the end of the process. You have to talk about it at the beginning. I don't know whether state law will allow us to negotiate. We've done some of this type of negotiation recently. We had a contract with a company, and they didn't have minority hiring in it. And they said, instead, we'll hire two apprenticeships for people that don't have jobs right now. And they will do that work. And they will train them so that they will be able the next time. You know, Charlotte has always worked with people. And some people question whether or not that's a valuable, is collaboration a valuable tool for us? I think that it is, because that's how we've grown and that's how we attract businesses today.
The mayor doesn't get a vote. How would you have voted? Could you have voted?
I would have voted to support the contract. I believe in small businesses. And it is a fact that small minority-owned businesses hire more minorities than majority-owned businesses because they understand what goes on. And there was a point made that maybe the people that are getting this would not even be able to qualify for a living wage. This might be the first job that leads to that job that does qualify for a living wage.
Okay. So there are several people on City Council: Julie Iselt, LaWanna Mayfield, James Mitchell, Reg Phipps, and Braxton Winston, who would like to see City Council go to four-year terms. They now have two-year terms. You have a two-year term.
Yes.
Yesterday, in the op-ed section of the paper, former City Councilman Kenny Smith wrote an opinion piece, in which he described this as one of the biggest power grabs in the history of the city, and said that this group of council members were voted into office on a platform of transparency, but ran this idea through the budget committee, which I guess means that it was off to the side someplace. Do you agree with any of that?
Can I roll my eyes here a bit? I'm sorry. You know, first of all, it isn't the budget committee. It is the Budget and Government Effectiveness Committee. The budget committee works really hard the first 6 months, and then they can deal with some of these issues about how we implement our processes and whatever. We have two advocates for four-year terms that I'm aware of on the council, Councilmember Winston and Mayor Pro Tem Iselt. And that effort by them, actually, Braxton Winston brought that to my attention. We referred it to the Budget and Government Effectiveness Committee, and they had one meeting and one discussion. If I could have 2 minutes, we could go through this, but I don't.
You do.
I do.
On the other side.
Okay, thank you.
Of the break, because I have a lot more questions about
this thing.
We'll also talk about Eastland Mall and the bonds. We'll talk a little bit more about the bonds on the ballot as well, and among other things. So stay with us. Vi Lyles is here, the mayor of Charlotte. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. The battle for control of Congress in the November midterm could hinge on a pair of races in the Charlotte area. The tension in Raleigh could depend on General Assembly races in our region. As Tar Heel voters get ready to decide the course of state and national politics, join us for a Charlotte Talks election special, Tuesday, October 23rd at 7 p.m., live from the Booth Playhouse in Founders Hall. Register to attend at wfae.org/charlottetalks. It's our monthly conversation with Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking right now about City Council and some on council advocating for four-year as opposed to two-year terms. And as I understand, the proposal that's already been floated is that the at-large candidates would run in opposite years from the district candidates. So everybody would be serving 4 years, but there'd be 2 years separating the district from the at-large. Julie Iselt wrote an article rebutting Kenny Smith's article in the paper, and this morning, former Mayor Roberts wrote a letter to the editor in which she essentially said this ought to go to a vote of the people. If council shouldn't be making this decision on its own, and she cited the fact that she was on both council and county commission and never decided on term lengths.
You know, the thing about the letters and the reporting and the columns, you know, I think some people like to get out ahead of the decision making because there have been no decisions being made around this. In fact, there's only been one discussion of the committee about this. Councilmember Winston brought this up as an idea that we ought to, and he actually proposed that structure. The council didn't discuss that at all. He came in with that, and I referred it to a committee because that's what we do. We really work to explore, and my charge to the committee was to research and make a recommendation on how and if.
Well, this is the, I think Julie Eisel pointed this out this morning. This is the largest big city in the country where the council has 2-year as opposed to 4-year terms. It's also one of the few cities in the country that has a part-time mayor.
That's true.
Have we reached a stage in this city's development where it's time to think more professionally, longer terms and a full-time mayor?
Well, we do have a professional system. We have a city manager that hires a number of very talented people. So our form of government is council manager.
Right.
And so we are looked at as policymakers. There's a lot of similarities here to the issue of the discussion about living wage. You know, these are big ideas that have to come through a process for scrutiny. And so there's been no decision made. They have, the committee has had one meeting to discuss it. They're meeting later on this month to discuss it again. And at that committee meeting, there were only 3 people on the committee because I think we had 2 people out sick or had circumstances. So when we look at this, the idea is to actually examine what people that advocate for it, as well as to hear from people that don't think it should happen.
The idea, as I understand it from Braxton Winston's point of view, is that with 2-year terms, newcomers to the council spend their first term trying to find the men's room or the women's room, and they have to run for office again. And those who have been on council for several years spend the first year of their term trying to do things, and then the second year of their term running for office, or at least thinking about running for office, which may impede their decision-making in some way. Do you think that's true? Do you think 4-year terms would change things for the better?
I think that what you say, it is true that 2-year terms often will slow the council down from certain activities, but that's because they're making it in a political environment. I tell you, I don't believe we're going to slow down this time, though. I believe that we're going to continue to act on our plans for housing and neighborhoods and recruitment of businesses. I think the practice in the past has been that. So let's talk about it. And then there are also some things that people would say, well, the voters need to have choice. And I don't know the answer to that, but this is a decision that I would best be discussed by a committee of the council and then have the voters come in, the residents of this community come in and talk about that idea before public hearings, even the way we do engagement. We don't actually just sit in the chamber anymore. We could go outside and talk to various groups about, is this a good idea? Mm-hmm. The decision, The state law allows us to do things in 3 different ways. We could have the citizens could do a petition to ask for this, just like they did in the early 70s to get district representation. The council could vote to do this, but there is a clause that allows 5,000 citizens by petition to say, no, we don't want to do it, put before a referendum, or we could just set it up as a referendum. Those are really big decisions that ought to be discussed by everyone, but that discussion has not even started yet.
So once the discussion starts, if the committee recommends 4-year terms and the council takes up this discussion at a full council meeting or 2 or 3, do you advocate that the council make that decision, or would you advocate for this going to a voter referendum?
I'm going to be very direct here. I am very concerned that we do this when we have this after the census. I believe in 2020, when we have the census and we'll have an idea of how we're growing, we're likely to have to redistrict our entire city right now. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about that, isn't it best to reflect when we know the majority of people that are here? And so I've said this to my colleagues on the council, I've said we've got a big population count coming up. That will be done in 2020. We'll be looking at, are we equally represented by population? And then how should we decide the vote? So right now, I don't have the urgency that some of the council members have on this. Mm-hmm. I sense that after our census count and then looking at government in that context would be better.
How long does it take for the census to come back
with
the results?
The census will be coming back pretty much in time for a 2021 election.
Okay, so we're at least 3 years away.
Well, we'll have data coming in, you know, that the census doesn't just roll out one result. We'll know more.
And actually, the census goes on all the time. People
it
just don't know.
It does. That's the point.
Okay. Damon on Facebook writes, I am for extending term limits. Council can't get anything done in such a short time. Amber on Facebook says we need to take a longer view to city management. I think the longer term is a good idea, but maybe just 3 years. Because if you're stuck in an awful commission, with an awful commission, 4 years is a very, very long time. I'm not sure what that means.
I don't either. But, Amber, I think your voice needs to be heard. I think those are the kinds of things that we have to listen to before we make a decision about this.
Kirby says if the city council wants to pursue four-year terms, shouldn't voters have a say? Going back to affordable housing, Marnie emails, I'm a part of a group that is interested in property for senior co-housing. We looked at the elementary school on Statesville Avenue, where classrooms could be converted to 1,200-square-foot apartments. Do you have any plans specifically for senior co-housing?
Well, if you would send me your ideas, and I am familiar with the senior co-housing process and policy and philosophy. So mayor@charlottenc.gov, please send me your ideas.
Okay. It was reported this week that the city is nearing a deal to transform the Eastland Mall site at a cost of $600,000. I thought this was already decided, but evidently it was only a preliminary vote. The cost would be split with private developers so that taxpayers would actually be spending about $250,000 on this. Why does the city have to help at all on this? If you sell the land to somebody, why do you have to kick money in to sweeten the deal for a deal the size of Eastland Mall?
You know, I would say to you that this has probably been one of the most discussed topics in the 6 years that I've served on the citizens of this community. And the idea of that discussion is the due diligence that protects us is worth the value of what we put into it. Because as you'll remember, we went through a very long time talking about a development that never had financial footing. And here we are today. So this idea of protecting our responsibilities and making sure that those steps are taken so that if we're working with someone, that kind of due diligence is important. And if it comes at a cost, I think that it's valued at it.
Okay, so the City Council Committee voted in August to recommend the proposal from Crossland Southeast, Odell, which is an architecture firm, and Eastland Community Development. The council is expected to vote on October the 22nd. Will they vote on the money aspect of that at that time?
That's what we'll be Economic Development Committee, which is chaired by James Mitchell, includes Matt Newton, who is the district representative from that area. Mm-hmm. And over the weekend, I started getting all these letters about Eastland, and I couldn't figure out why, because there's been a lot of misinformation that goes over social media often, and Matt Newton and James Mitchell have been clarifying that this is a step taking the recommended developer forward to due diligence so that we can then come out and say this is what it's going to take to get that site developed. And, you know, I'm, again, as mayor, when I look at this, I'm thinking about the opportunity zone. Eastland is in an opportunity zone, and that's where we're getting developers get tax credits that can help them do the right thing. And this due diligence is important to make sure that we do that.
So the $250,000 is due diligence?
It is actually due diligence around the looking at that developer and saying, can they do this? You remember the, what was it, Soundstage?
Yes.
The Youth Center and all of that. It also
tells us.
They
didn't have the funding to do it.
That's right.
Big dreams, not
big
enough
dreams.
Money.
And this, we're not dreaming anymore. We're trying to get this
thing. So if the council is probably going to vote yes, but if they vote no, does that end this project, or would the developers likely go forward with it in some way
I have no idea what the developers would do. They've been working with Tracy Dotson, the new assistant manager for economic development, but I can't speculate on what they're going to do.
Okay. Larry emails something that probably people are curious about in general. What are the main differences and the power difference between the mayor and the city manager?
Wow. Okay, so I have to say that in North Carolina, once a city gets beyond 20,000 people in population, the state law requires us to have professional management. And that's the case to, in large part, to prevent corruption, the idea that you're running the city, you might decide to contract with your neighbor or whatever. North Carolina is known as the good government state, and they made that decision a long time ago. So one, we are having city manager form of government because the city manager is responsible ethically and by his oath of office to manage the city in a way that is professionally done, and primarily that's around how you spend taxpayers' money. The mayor is a role that has, for North Carolina, Charlotte has one of the strongest mayor responsibilities because the mayor has veto power and has appointment power for various committees and boards. The mayor's real power lies in setting the vision and the influence to get things done, rallying our community around things that need to be done, whereas the city manager doesn't have that responsibility. His responsibility is to implement the policy decisions made by the city council with six or more votes.
Does the corruption deterrent really work? We've had a mayor who was arrested and jailed on charges of corruption because of an FBI sting, and I suppose had it not been for the FBI sting, that those things that led to his arrest may have continued without knowledge of anybody.
Well, I think if you look at it, the things were not inside the city manager's purview. The things that he was doing were under his influence. When I say that the mayor has influence, he was actually, from my perspective, being asked to influence things. Mm-hmm. And that takes a person to discern what kind of person they want to be. And in this case, I think that he acknowledges his failure at doing that at that time.
So we now have the dates for the 2020 Republican National Convention. They will be here August 24th through 27th, and probably a little earlier and a little later for many of those folks. And you've said that we, quote, we are very excited about this opportunity. But not everybody was very happy about this when this came down.
I didn't say happy. I didn't say people were happy. I know excited in both ways. Very unhappy and excited about it, and happy and excited
about
it.
Has some of this excitement died down? Has some of the opposition calmed?
I think that the acceptance that we're doing this has had the idea of how do we move forward. And so people are putting planning and strategies in place, no matter whether you're coming down to protest or if you're coming down as a guest or a visitor to this community. The next year will be spent to prepare for both of those options.
And you've also said that this is going to provide a cultural experience for the city's school children to see the political process in their midst. Why do you think they will get anything more out of this than if the convention was held in Saskatchewan and put on television?
Because, Mike, I worked at the Democratic National Convention as the person that did the community organizing for this.
Okay.
And we actually had student editors of student newspapers come down. We gave lectures by politicians. We had discussion of issues. And the requirement was that they had to write an article for their student newspaper about their experience. And they did a great job at that. They actually were sitting in the Blumenthal Theater with Mayor Nutter, a mayor from Italy. All of those folks came through that. I just really believe that this is, UNC Charlotte has 100 students that come from their coalition of colleges, and they come down and actively participate in this, not just showing up and reading about it, but actively speaking to people about our country and the policies that we have.
So we have 90 seconds left.
Okay.
And there are $223.08 million in bonds on the ballot in November. We've already talked a little bit about the affordable housing bonds at $50 million. What about the neighborhood improvement bonds?
Neighborhood improvement bonds do build our sidewalks where we have to retrofit. It helps us build our storm drainage system out. So those are the things that make a neighborhood great. Tree canopies, good sidewalks, and good streets.
Then there is $118.08, I don't know why the 08 is there, but $1 million in transportation bonds earmarked for several projects. Give us a few.
And those projects are those areas where we've identified thoroughfares that we want to do in every quadrant of the city. But more importantly, there's money there to implement our bike plan, $4 million. And there's money to begin to consider how we keep pedestrians safe.
When will we see, if voters say yes, when will we see results from that yes vote?
Oh, you know, you're still seeing results from votes that were made years ago. So this is the money. We'll start immediately on a construction plan. We're trying to move more quickly. So hopefully 2 to 3 years.
How will this impact taxes?
You remember last year we had a penny tax increase. 3/4 of that was to help pay police, and 1/4 of it was to support the bonds.
I thought you were going to tell me that the bonds weren't going to impact the taxes at all.
No, I'm honest about it. It said one cent increase last year, I think, was well spent.
Mayor Vi Lyles, for her monthly conversation with us on this program. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.